Well, going back to the discovery of seven, I put this up, by the way, just to make sure that we actually don't spend too much time on the scientific discovery. We have a habit of doing that in this class, so I'm going to move through it. And frankly, when I heard about it, I thought, well, this is going to be no big deal, and no point writing anything about it. But then our social media guy had reason to believe that this is really taking off. You've got to get an article out. So I stopped everything and wrote an article. It's up on my Facebook page. It's on my blog. And already 31,000 people have seen it. So it's like, it really is a big story.
Wow.
And it's a big story because of the way NASA framed the press release. There's probably a lot of you heard. They found seven planets in one planetary system orbiting a star that's close to us. And they said that three of the seven are in the habitable zone. Maybe all seven of them are in the habitable zone. And this is a great place to look for life. Now, that was a NASA press release. And the thing I've been encouraging people on my Facebook and Twitter is that when you hear an announcement like that, always dig down and get the peer-reviewed papers. And yeah, a lot of hype from NASA, but the peer-reviewed papers are quite subdued in what they claim. Don't badmouth the scientists. They did their job. They were honest about what they discovered, what they didn't discover. But a lot of people are accusing NASA of using this as a fundraising ploy. So, but I remember speaking to NASA Houston a few years ago just saying, you know, if NASA were actually to honestly report what they were discovering, they would probably get more public support and more funding. Because what happens if you cry wolf too many times, that could actually impact the funding. So let me pop up some slides I got here for you. This is what NASA released on their website. Was this one right here. Yeah. Basically showing you, and they refer to it as Earth's seven sisters. Mm-hmm. So these are seven sister planets to Earth. And what they show you is, let me bring up this next slide. Shows you pretty how Earth-like they are. So here we got Earth, and you look up there, and they're all roughly the same size as the Earth. So that was the motivation for saying, we have found seven sister planets to the Earth. What they weren't sharing with the public is that it's quite typical that planets of all different masses have relatively similar diameters. And so, yeah, if you look at the fine print here, you probably have a hard time reading it. And now you'll see this in my article. I said, forget about the diameters of these planets. Look at the masses. The mass of the planet really tells you how Earth-like it is. And, well, if you look at the masses, these seven sister planets, or sister planets, if you're willing to call Mars a sister planet and Venus a sister planet. In fact, when you look at the masses, only one of them is closer to Earth's mass than Venus is. Venus is about 81% of Earth's mass, and one of the planets comes in at approximately 84%. So it's slightly closer to Earth's mass than Venus is. But all the other six depart quite a bit from Venus and is similar to its mass. So in that sense, it's really a misnomer to refer to these as sister planets of the Earth. They're not sister planets of the Earth. And if you're talking about being able to sustain life, the mass of the planet must be within 1% of the mass of Earth. The mass of a planet is very sensitive to what kind of life you get. If you want anything besides a very simple bacterium, the mass of the planet has to be almost exactly the mass what we see here on planet Earth. That's especially so if you want life to last longer than a half billion years. And for any hope of any advanced life, you have to have a long history of life. And so none of them fall in that category. In that sense, it's a mistake to refer to them as Earth-like.
It's amazing how planet E has clouds.
Well, that's something a lot of people commented on, because I put these slides up on my Facebook page and said, are they really able to see the colors and the features of these planets? No, these are just artist guesses as to what they might look like. So, matter of fact, they can't even see the light of the planet. How these planets were discovered was by the transit method. The planet would, in its orbit, go in front of the star, and that would cause the light of the star to dim a little bit. And so by that means, they're able to measure the diameter of the star, but in this case, they got the masses as well. So they know the mass of the planet, they know the diameter of the planet, they know the orbit of the planet, and that's it. However, this system is close enough that when the James Webb Telescope comes online, and it keeps getting delayed, but there's hope that it will be launched in 2018, maybe even late 2017, we'll see, it will have the power to be able to determine what kind of atmosphere these planets have. But right now, we have no idea whether they have an atmosphere. Given their mass and their diameter, they probably don't have thick atmospheres. Matter of fact, they may not have much of an atmosphere at all, based on what I'll share with you shortly. Now, the most unusual thing about these planets is how close they are to their star. And so this is not from NASA. I developed this, and so you can see. This is the star, TRAPPIST-1. And what I put here is how close Mercury would be. So this shows you Mercury compared to our solar system and how close these planets are to their star compared to how close Mercury is to our sun. So you can see they're really right next to the star. Now, the big idea is all of these planets might be in the habitable zone. They say certainly three of them are in the habitable zone. And that's because the star that they're orbiting is extremely faint. You say, how faint? Well, we're looking at visual wavelengths. It's 3/1,000,000th the brightness of the sun. This star is as dim as it can possibly be and still be a star. I mean, it's at the very minimum mass of what's necessary for a star to ignite nuclear fusion. And so it's extremely dim. Now, they use what's called a bolometric luminosity, which basically takes into account all of its heat and light, because most of the light of this star is coming out of infrared wavelengths, and in that case, it's about 1/10,000th the brightness of our star, the sun. But the visual wavelengths is only 3/1,000,000th. Either way you cut it, it's a really dim star.
What is its magnitude as far as from Earth?
I don't know its relative.
You can't see it with the naked eye.
Oh, you can't see it with the naked eye. You know, you need a big telescope to see it. It's relatively close. I think its distance is like 39 light years away.
Correct.
And so given that it's that close, we can actually see it. But it literally is as small and as dim as a star can possibly be and still be a star. So, and the reason why they say these planets are in the habitable zone, they're only looking at one habitable zone, what's called the liquid water habitable zone, which would be the distance from the star where water conceivably be in liquid form. And so being an extremely dim star, the planets have to be really close to be in that liquid water habitable zone. And these three right here, not this one or the interior ones, but these three have the highest likelihood of having a temperature on the surface of the planet where water could exist in liquid form. That's all what they mean when they say a planet is habitable. Is it conceivable that the temperature on the surface is equivalent to what you need for water to be in liquid form? Yes.
The big problem I have with you with that description, my friend, those three planets are habitable zone, and that's from mean heat. The problem is this star variability is so huge that the zone is actually moving way out and way in.
Well, that's another factor I was going to get to.
Yeah.
Is what you notice in the peer-reviewed paper, you don't see this in the NASA announcement, but in the peer-reviewed paper, they tell you the rotation rate of the star. It rotates once every 1.4 days. So that means it's a very fast rotating star. To give you an idea, our star, the sun, has a rotation rate of over 26 days. As well known in astronomy, the faster a star rotates, the more unstable it is. This is an extremely unstable star. So any faint star, and the dimmer the star, the more unstable it is, and the faster it rotates, the more unstable it is, and the younger it is, the more unstable it is. They have a very crude estimate of its age, roughly 1 billion years. The error bar on that is plus or minus 1 billion. So, which is not unusual for single stars that are very dim. It's very hard to determine their age. And is it, what did come out in the NASA announcement is that this might be a great place for us to think about going when our planet becomes uninhabitable. Why? Because this star is so dim, it can burn for 10 trillion years. Our star is going to burn out in another 4.5 billion. So when that happens, we need to abandon our Earth and head off to a place where there's a star that burns a lot longer. So that explains why they have such a very crude estimate on its age. Because when a star can burn that long, it's really hard to get an estimate of its age. I'll take a question, and I want to continue.
Can you briefly elaborate why a planet's mass must be within 1% of the Earth's mass to support life above bacteria?
Okay. Because you need plate tectonics to be strong and stable and long enduring. And you'll see this in my book, Improbable Planet. In fact, you've got to be a lot closer than 1% of the mass of our planet in order for that to be even a possibility. Not all planets of that mass will have that condition, but it is a required condition if you want plate tectonics to be sustained for very long. And the thing there is, without plate tectonics, and without continents and oceans coexisting, this is something that Jeff talked about in his talk yesterday. If you don't have a planet where you've got oceans and continents on its surface, there's no way you can compensate for the brightening of the star. And all stars brighten as they convert hydrogen to helium through nuclear fusion. And so that means you might be able to have bacteria existing for a few hundred thousand years and then you're done. So and that's not a very exciting idea to think about. So, but yeah, the star is a very fast rotator. And also, one thing we notice about stars that rotate very rapidly and are very dim is they tend to be very active and throwing out lots of flares and really intense flares, killer flares. That's another problem for trying to claim these planets are habitable. If you've got a strong flaring star, it's no way it's going to be habitable. I mean, you've got a strong flaring star, it's also going to be pumping out ultraviolet radiation and X-ray radiation, which caused me to do a literature search. And you know, one of the wonderful things about science these days, you can read the papers before they get published in the journals. And also what's interesting is that these preprints, and often the preprints come out 6 to 9 months before they show up in the journals. And here's a tip. You can read those papers in their entirety for free. Once they get in the journals, you've got to pay anywhere from $30 to $40 to read the paper. But in the preprint form, they're free. And incidentally, typically, they remain as preprints even after they're published. So that's just a tip. If you want to read these scientific papers for free, then, you know, go for the preprint, not the published paper.
Is that a website?
Well, the website is ARXIV. That's where all the preprints in the physical sciences are posted. And they're also categorized for high energy physics, astrophysics, etc. So that can help.
That's accessible to the public?
It's accessible to the public. Again, totally free.
Okay.
Are they identical at that point when they get published?
Okay, here's another tip. What you want to look for in the preprints, they typically come out as version one, which means that's the first time that the authors have put it up there. It's draft one, and version two, version three will come out. They're all maintained. But what you want to look for is when they've been submitted to a journal and accepted by a journal. So if you can see on the preprint, submitted to the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, that means it has a high likelihood, because you know the authors won't put that on there if they're at all concerned that it won't be accepted. So that usually means it's guaranteed to be published, and you just have to wait a little while before it comes out. So that's what I did. I went to this archive site where they have all these preprints, and I found a paper, not yet published, but it did say that it's been submitted to the monthly notice of the Royal Astronomical Society. What it was a group of scientists who weren't interested in the planets, but they were interested in the star. So what they did is they took Britain's X-ray telescope, the Newton telescope that's orbiting in, around our planet, and they focused it on the star, and they noticed it's pumping out huge quantities of X-ray radiation. which is what you'd expect for a really dim star that's rotating fast. So it confirmed that indeed it's pouring out the flares, the X-ray radiation, and the ultraviolet radiation that would be catastrophic for life on these planets. So by that token alone, it's not habitable. And incidentally, the people who put that paper, who wrote that paper, they weren't interested in the habitability part. They were saying, with all that X-ray radiation, chances are these planets don't have an atmosphere that would be conducive to life, because the X-ray radiation would be eroding the chemicals that would be critical to life. That was kind of their focus of the paper. And the NASA team weren't aware of the paper, but I give you a link to the paper in the article that you'll see on my Facebook page, so you can check that out. So that's kind of what I try to do in the article. They're supposed to actually give you the peer-reviewed papers that are relevant to what's happening. Yes.
You put bacterial life exists without an atmosphere?
Bacterial life can exist without an atmosphere. People have been speculating that there might be bacteria in a subterranean ocean on Jupiter's planet Europa, for example. So that's a possibility. Now, the problem with the Europa idea is that life cannot originate under a subterranean ocean, mainly because you need certain oxidant chemicals for an origin of life to be possible. Pardon me, it's the other way around. You need the oxidants to sustain the bacteria, but if the oxidants are present, it stops the possibility of an origin of life model. So that's kind of the paradox of Europa. Yeah, you may be able to conceive of a way a bacterium can exist there, but there's no way it could originate there. It has to be able to originate and survive. So, okay, that's off the subject matter. One of the things that did come out in the Nature articles, the peer-reviewed papers, what didn't show up again in the NASA announcement, is that at least four of these planets are in resonance with one another. And that's a technical term that means, for example, that the innermost planet, by the way, the innermost planet, it goes around TRAPPIST-1 in 1.4 days. So it's really zipping around. I mean, it's got a year that's equivalent to our day. That's how close it is to its star. And so, I mean, it's literally in the corona sphere of the star. It's only a million miles away from the star. So, and you say, well, what is that like? Well, the star is about a half million miles in diameter. So you've got this big star, and the planet is really just beyond the diameter of the star. So I can give you an idea. This is about 1 million miles, and this is about 6 million miles out. So they're really jammed very tightly towards the star. But yeah, the innermost four, and maybe all of them, are in resonance. What they're able to determine is that the innermost planet goes around the star 8 times, for every 5 times the next one goes around the star, for every 3 times the next one goes around the star, 2 and 1. And when you get those resonances, where you get these small integers for planets that are making orbits above the star, that means that they're going to line up frequently with one another. When they line up, they gravitationally pull and tug on one another. And what that does is it causes the planets to move back and forth a bit, and also it affects their rotation. Because what is well known is that these planets must be tidally locked. They're orbiting so close to the star, they have to be tidally locked. If you're not familiar with that term, our moon is tidally locked to Earth. The moon is so close to the Earth that the gravity of Earth on the near side of the moon is quite a bit stronger than the gravity in the far side of the moon. And that gravitational difference basically forces one side of the moon to always face us, which is why you can't see the back side of the moon from the Earth, because its rotation rate is identical to its revolution rate. Oh. It rotates once every 29 days, but it revolves once every 29 days, so you get to see one side of the moon. And people have said, well,
that's amazing.
What that means is it's going to be really hot on the front side because it's facing the star, and it's going to be close to absolute zero on the dark side. So you've got a very cold one. But then people said, well, maybe it's still habitable because you've got that edge the Twilight Zone. So we're right on the edge of having a blazing hot and really cold. But when you've got resonance, what happens is the twilight edge wiggles a little bit. And when it wiggles, it's going to get really hot and really cold. So for sure, we know these planets, if they have water on it, they're bone dry. That water is long ago either gone into a completely frozen state or has evaporated off into space. And with a wiggling like that, the water is gone from both sides. And so, yeah, they might be in what's called the water habitable zone, but if it's bone dry, it's not going to help you to be in the water habitable zone. So then the other thing they've noticed is that with the planets that close to their star and in resonance, they couldn't have formed there. They must have formed way far out, probably farther away than Mercury is from our star, the Sun. And then they drifted in. And what would cause them to drift in? Lots of asteroids and comets. That's the other thing you picked up, too, if you look at the peer-reviewed papers, is that the star is much more metal-rich than the Sun. And that's common for these small stars. But the other significant factor, they haven't detected a gas giant planet on this system. Mm. Now, if you've got a gas giant, and the gas giant drifts in towards its star, it tends to clear out the asteroids and comets. Yeah. But if you don't have a gas giant, that doesn't happen. So what that means is this system is probably really loaded with millions, actually billions, of big comets and asteroids. What does that mean? That means these planets are being bombarded very heavily by all the debris that exists in the system. So, and you know, what I commented on in my Facebook article is that, you know, everything that you can think of that would make this planet uninhabitable is the case for this system. So, which makes it mysterious why NASA hyped this. I think it would have been better for them if they said, we've actually found a system with seven planets orbiting the stars really closely. I mean, that's exciting, and it's close by, and we're going to be able to see what kind of atmosphere they had, maybe get some idea of its chemistry. That, to me, is enough hype. As an astronomer, that would make me really excited. But when they're talking about the habitability, it's like, hey, wait a minute. Why are you overselling this? So, and that's something we reminded at by the AMP conference yesterday. Mm-hmm. If you want to be an effective witness for Christ, make sure you don't oversell. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Last question. Move on.
Okay.
Can I ask it?
Yeah, you can ask it.
Ask it.
Real brief. Just to backtrack a little bit about this bit with the moon rotating at the same speed, you know, like you were explaining. And I just have to say something about this. You know, I mean, that and also the fact that in the total solar eclipse, it just exactly blocks out the circumference of the sun. I'm speaking in lay terms.
Right.
It, to me, that's just absolutely more than a coincidence, you know, and I'm sure most believers here would agree with that, but I think that should be pointed out. You agree with that? Is that like a scientific thing throughout all the stars or solar systems and stuff, as far as we know? It's very unique, right?
Yeah. It's extremely rare that you would get an occulting body the same size as the star. And it's especially interesting in the fact that the moon is moving away from the Earth.
Okay.
Which means in the relatively near future, there will be no total solar eclipses to observe because the moon's diameter in the sky is going to be smaller than the diameter of the moon.
So while we're here on this Earth, we have the opportunity to see this. But my question is also about the synchronization between the moon's orbit and the where we only see one side of the moon.
Well, okay. Just like I was mentioning how these planets, because they're in synchronous, you know, they're in resonance with one another, the twilight edge wiggles a little bit. The twilight edge on our moon also wiggles a little bit. That's because of Jupiter and Saturn, it wiggles slightly. So when you say, well, we can only see one half of the moon, actually you can see about 57% of the moon because of the wiggle effect. So, but that's common with all tidally locked planets. You know, a lot of astronomers are saying, hey, the twilight edge is where to go. But if the twilight edge moves, that's not going to help you. And almost always, I mean, if you've got another planet in the system, it's going to wiggle. The question is by how much. But with all these planets in it, it's going to wiggle quite a bit. So, All right, we're going to move on. If you want to read more details, you can go to Facebook or my blog and get the scoop there. And I also give you the links to the papers. And if you want to read the papers, and the preprints, as I said, you can read it in its entirety. And it's not that technical to read. So just ignore the equations and keep going. You'll be fine. All right. Okay. Those of you that are new here, what we're doing is we're going through the entire Bible and looking at all the major texts that deal with the subject of creation and science. We've been in this study for a few years now. We've made it to the book of Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes indeed has a lot of content and science creation on it. But the other thing we're doing is similar to what was happening in the Ant Conference we just had, in the sense that we're looking at the book of Ecclesiastes as a guide on how to bring a certain kind of unbeliever to faith in Christ. And we're now in chapter 7, moving on to chapter 8. But we had a number of you, there were six groups of you here who gave a report on your study of the fool. Because what you notice in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon begins by talking about his life experience. He doesn't mention God much. He doesn't mention foolishness much. But as you move from chapter 5 to 6 to 7, he gets a lot more explicit about God and what keeps us away from God, namely our foolishness. And there are five Hebrew words for fool. We got a great report on all of them. And I think I lost control when Ellen gave her report, where she found that verse where it says the fool always looks to the left, but the wise man always looks to the right. Incidentally, that's not in all translations. But she found one. So thank you, Ellen, for that bit of non-political insight into what's going on with the fool. But some of you heard at AMP yesterday in the very first AMP talk from Sean McDowell. The Bible says the fool says in his heart there is no God. That's the kind of fool we're focusing on. The one who's, and it's not so much that he says there is no God, it's like they live their lives as if there is no God. That's kind of the fool that we're addressing. How do you bring him to Christ? Now look what Sean said. The last thing you want to do is quote Psalm 14:1 to this individual. I mean, you're going to immediately lose any potential to bring him to Christ. We just start off by saying, hey, look at the Bible. It says the fool says in his heart there is no God.
You're a fool.
Yeah, you're a fool, and this is your situation. And we've just caused a major offense. But what we need to do, and you know, I've been giving you a set of questions on what kind of individual you're dealing with and how do we use the insight from the last seven chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes and how we can approach these people and bring them in to the Christian fold as followers of Jesus Christ. Now, I've had this slide up at the beginning because this book has just been published. It was released on the 17th of February. Even before it was released, it was on the bestseller list. People were buying it in advance. And, right now it's number 50 on Amazon, and it got a lot better than that after just in the days it was released. And what I find interesting, if you want a really best-selling book, all you've got to do is find some way to put
Homo Diaz. YUVALNOAHHARARI.
But I'm bringing this to your attention because I think you're going to have a lot of opportunities to talk to people. People are talking about this book. I mean, I see a lot of buzz on the web about this. And it's interesting in that it presents a 21st century fool who says in his heart there is no God. And it's written by a Jew, not an Orthodox Jew. He's a professor at the Hebrew University, Yuval Noah Harari, and he's written a previous bestseller on Homo sapiens, or the book which is simply called Sapiens, and it was about the past history of humanity. This is looking at the future history of humanity, and he's making a modest claim. He says, I'm only going to look at the next 100 years. So it's just a brief history of tomorrow. We're only going to look at 100 years. I'm not going to look at 1,000. His background is he's an historian. He's a professor of history, but he's trained as an anthropologist. So he's not formally trained in history, but that's where he teaches. But his background is anthropology. And you can kind of tell by the title of the book that it's all about how we human beings are becoming God. And I think you can see, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Hey, we don't need a God, we're God. So that's one version of this kind of fool. And I'll give you a little brief comment on what this book is all about. Then I want to solicit from all of you, how are you going to respond to people who are excited about this book? Because I think this is going to give each of you really good opportunities to share your Christian faith. It's going to happen. I just kind of want to get you ready. Well, as you get into the book, the first thing it says is that it looks like in the 21st century, we human beings are well on our way to becoming God. In a sense, look at what's happened in the 21st century. Because for the first time in human history, more people die from overeating than undereating. Because that's been the problem with humanity, is we've had poor people who hadn't had enough to eat, or they don't have enough nutrition in their diet, and they wind up getting sick and having an early death as a result. He says today it's the reverse. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that it's the poorest people on the planet that are most subject to obesity. For the simple reason is that our technology has made it possible for us to produce a lot of food, but the cheapest food to produce is the food that's very high in sugar and starch. And so it's the poor people that struggle with obesity, whereas in the past it was the poor people who couldn't find enough food to eat. The other thing he points out that tells us that society has really changed is he says what's really interesting is if you look at human history, and he's an historian after all, there's always been wars and civil wars and unrest, where millions of people die as a result of conflict between human beings. And he says, even if you don't have a war, people are murdering one another. They get into conflicts with one another, they're murdering one another. But he says, look at the progress we've made in the 21st century. We're now at a time where the suicide rate is greater than the murder rate and the loss of life from all wars combined. Now, you might want to question that statistic.
Yeah, is that true?
Yeah, big question.
Well, you know, having dug into it, what he does is he selects, you know, kind of, so he's looking at a very short window of time, about a 3-year window of time, and it's true. In that time window, you actually see more people dying from suicide than people dying from murder. In fact, he makes the point, even if you throw in car accidents and a murder rate and people dying in war, the rate of death from suicide is still greater than all of that combined. Now, he says that means we human beings are solving our social problems. Notice that war is no longer having the impact that it used to have. The murder rate has gone down, so we're doing well there. And hey, cars are safer. Not so many of us are dying in accidents. But the court of raises the question, why is the suicide rate so high? Okay. And he's kind of pretending that the suicide rate is kind of stable. What's happened is the rate of death from murder and wars and accidents has declined, whereas the suicide rate, but I think that could be questioned. The suicide rate in some countries are skyrocketing. So maybe that's got a lot more to do with the statistic. The other thing he points out in the book is that we're making amazing progress in technology, and that's true. And he says, he talks a lot about disk drives. Now, keep in mind, he has no background in the computer science. He's an historian and an anthropologist. And I noticed looking at the reviews of the book, a lot of people who are scientists and engineers are very much questioning this, saying he's writing about science. That the most common critique I've heard is, yes, it's a book about science, but in reality, it's science fiction, it's not science. But he does make this interesting point. He talks about what has happened with computer storage devices. You know, and Dave, you could speak to this, is that the fact, Kathy, I can remember when we first started working on the fingerprint of God, it's like,
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if we could have a 10-megabyte hard disk? All this stuff. But a 10-megabyte hard disk was like $5,000. There's no way we could afford it. And so we had to make do with these little floppy things, and it was just a real challenge, even trying to get a book done, which is relatively low memory. And so he makes the point, hey, you know, incidentally, I can take you back earlier. When I first began to do research in astronomy as a graduate student, I was actually using 25% of the computing power of the University of Toronto. So here's a campus of 40,000 students, a single graduate student. I was consuming 25% of their total computing capacity.
Which is why they wanted to rush you through.
Well, how I got that 25%, I volunteered to run the computer from midnight to 6 a.m. And in the winter time, where you had to go across, and I had to walk 4 blocks to get my computer cards over to the computing center. I had 15 below, and nobody else wanted to go outside at that time of night. So that's how I was able to capture all that time and get my thesis done.
Computer cards? Like punch cards?
Yes.
Yeah, punch
yes.
cards. And we're going back.
He goes
to the
way
dark
back.
Ages, punch cards, yeah. Shortly after the dinosaurs rolled here. That's how my sons would describe it anyway. But yeah, I mean, the only way I could get my thesis done was to use their greatest storage capacity, which was a 2 megabyte drum. The drum was the size of an oil barrel, actually bigger than an oil barrel.
It looked like a washing machine.
Yeah, and it was the biggest storage device in all of Canada at that time. And it's the biggest one that existed anywhere in the world. There was a couple more here in the U.S. So we've gone from that to where you can carry a terabyte in your pocket. I mean, that's how much technology has advanced. I mean, this computer I got here has got a terabyte, and I can put in drives that have several terabytes on it. And now we're talking to going to even greater stores than that. Yes?
Hugh, what year did the internet really start?
Well, it depends who you talk to. I mean, there's a former vice presidential candidate who claimed that he had actually got that going in the late 1980s. But it was really the early 1990s before Joe Blow could actually access the military. He was working with it. That is one feature where our reasons to believe is unique, in that we were the first Christian organization to have a website. That was wonderful. We got to win Best Christian Website of the Year. Also known as the only Christian website.
Hey, we have a saying in our family, Apple Wayne is showing up.
Right. Well, actually, it was thanks to a software engineer that worked for the Air Force that we were able to get a website up and running before even Focus on the Family had one up and running. So. Needless to say, after about a year and a half went by, we stopped being the best website of the year. So, but what this book is talking about is that very soon we're going to be able to take the entire memory in a human brain and put it on a hard drive.
Ooh, pin.
Yeah. Okay. So, if you're worried about your failing memory, no problem. Just transfer everything in your brain to a hard drive. You can access it anytime. But he talks about how, within a decade, we're going to be able to interface a supercomputer with the brain, which means they're going to be able to make your brain actually operate at the speed of the supercomputer.
Do you
and
see
so
danger
all of us
that?
Are going to become super smart.
There's danger to that.
Is there a danger for that?
Well, yeah. I mean, this book has been critiqued by several computer science experts and say that's pure pie in the sky. I mean, the idea of that, or even the idea that the human brain could accommodate the information flow from the supercomputer. But that's kind of the claim that he makes. And then he goes on to say, very quickly, we're going to be able to bring the woolly mammoth back.
And who wants to?
It's possible. It's a long shot. Because, you know, you got to be able to recover the genome from mammoth. We do have mammoth tissue that we can use to get the genome. However, the Most recent tissue we have is still about 2,000 years old. And just a tiny piece. And just in 2,000 years, there's a lot of genomic decay that takes place. You don't get a perfect copy of the genome. And so they said, well, no problem. I mean, some of you, I'm sure, watched that movie series, Jurassic Park,
yeah, sure.
Where they actually admitted, we're not going to have the complete genome, but we just fill it in. And, of course, that's part of the story of Jurassic Park. The parts they filled in kind of caused them some problems, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's what they're thinking about with the woolly mammoth. We can just fill in some stuff from elephant to genome, and, hey, they're relatively close anyway, the idea is to actually produce an embryo of a woolly mammoth, put it inside a female elephant, she'll give birth to a woolly mammoth, and we're all set. But he goes on to that. He says, for $30 million in today's dollars, we can bring back the Neanderthals.
Ooh.
Now, I'm not sure we want to do that. We can bring back, and that's the point. Again, an anthropologist, he's an anthropologist, so you think, well, he's got to know what he's talking about. But a number of anthropologists jumped on this one. 30 million, no way. Moreover, the best genome we have for a Neanderthal maybe is two-thirds complete. And that's been criticized as being an exaggerated claim. And therefore, the idea of bringing back the Neanderthal at all. But as far as I know, the only extinct species we have a chance of bringing back are a couple of rhinoceros species, and maybe the woolly mammoth, but the woolly mammoth is a long shot. Neanderthal, really, that's kind of the claim of the book. We're going to be able to bring back all these extinct species, but the real claim of the book is we're going to be able to achieve immortality. Okay, because we can store all of our stuff in our brain on a hard drive, and that means we can repair what's going on in the brain. So if you've got, because all human brains tend to decay with time, not a problem, back it up on a hard drive, fix the brain, and then bring it all back. I mean, we do that routinely with computers, right? There's something wrong with your computer, just, you back up your hard drive, and then you fix your computer, put it all back, you're all set. So we're going to be able to do that with the human brain. Moreover, we're going to be able to do it with the rest of your organs. And so, and incidentally, that's actually a possibility. I mentioned here a couple of weeks ago that they're doing experiments on pigs where they're able to take, stem cells from you and possibly put them in a pig and grow an organ for you. And so, I mean, don't worry about your organs failing. There's going to be a pig over there that has your kidneys in it, your heart in it, your pancreas in it. And so when you need a new one, just go to your friendly pig and open up. And the pig, of course, is going to die as a result, but not a problem. They get another pig to take over. And so every human being can have a bunch of pigs to produce the organs that they need. And he says we'll be able to do that with skin and everything, and therefore immortality is not a problem.
That's
science fiction.
Kosher laws for him.
Interesting point. Howard Hughes going to feel about the missing face? I think that would not be a problem. This fellow is a Jew, and he says it wouldn't be a problem for Jews as long as we don't eat the meat, no problem.
Just miss out on the bacon.
And his whole point is these organs you're growing inside these pigs are actually your tissue. It's not the pig's tissue, it's your tissue. Now, having settled that, this was published 2 weeks ago in the literature that this may be a possibility. Emphasis on may be. Okay? There's a lot of technological challenges that have to be met. Now, having read the papers, there's a possibility. But it's a possibility, not a probability. Anyway, this is where the book is going. This is why it has the title Homo Deus. Is that we're in the 21st century now. Look at all these technological advances we've made. We can actually achieve immortality, and we can do it at less than 100 years. So it might not help me, but for those of you that are younger, you're going to have the potential of taking advantage of this technology and literally living forever. Yeah.
It's interesting, Hugh, obviously. I love looking at science and things, and when you look at the explosion of knowledge, that we know so much about the universe, or applied sciences, the human brain is the biggest mystery still. I mean, scientists, they know how neurons connect, but as far as consciousness and brain and memory and visual recognition, audio, smells, We know very little about the human brain. You know, as far as what is it, all that's capable, the hardware doesn't account for everything it can do, and the scientists really don't have answers there. So it's interesting that he puts this all this emphasis on the human brain when we don't even understand the human brain right now.
Well, the fool says in his heart there is no God, and what he's referring to are these individuals who are physicalists. And incidentally, there are a lot of evangelical Christians that identify themselves as physicalists. A physicalist is a person who thinks physics and chemistry explains everything, including consciousness, including your soul, including your spirit, which is why they would say it's actually possible to take everything in your brain, put it on a hard drive, fix everything that's wrong with you in your brain, if you got Alzheimer's or whatever, we can fix all that. And once we've got it all fixed, we just simply pour all that memory back in there and you're as good as new. And, of course, there are actually people speculating, hey, if for some reason you don't live long enough for this technology, no problem. When you get close to death, just transfer everything that's in here to a hard drive. When the technology comes along, we can give you a body and put all that stuff back in, and you'll be living forever. So, yeah, go ahead.
You mentioned the spirit. I think that's the heart of the problem of evil versus righteousness in the long term. I would challenge you to put in the big verse about Muhammad and see what happens with murder personally. But in the long term for immortality, we need to think about free will. Now, free will means, at least until we're renewed, that we have a very big problem to overcome of murder, death, of other things, and that's not God. And my favorite joke is, before the favorite joke is, I went to a Veritas forum, and one of the speakers said, I just follow my bottom line axiom, and I don't see a need for God. One of the great questions came up. He says, well, what is your bottom line axiom about the creation of the universe? How did it come? And his answer was, well, we have negative energy that came to matter, and they balance out to zero. And the guy probed him, well, what's negative energy?
And so
his bottom line axiom, he, as a speaker, had to go away and think, thank goodness, about that. And that's sort of like the bottom line axiom for all of us.
Well, what's interesting about this book, he's actually claiming we're overcoming the problem of evil. The murder rate's going down. Wars are not as bad as they used to be in terms of the death rate.
The only way I can see that happen is to put a chip in my brain and everybody else's that doesn't work to my free will.
Right. Well, I mean, that's something we can discuss here. I mean, his claim is we're conquering the problem of evil, we're conquering the problem of mortality, and we actually are on our way to becoming God, and we're going to achieve that in just one century. That's kind of the bottom line of the book. But is it really true that evil is disappearing right before our eyes?
No.
Absolutely not.
I mean, when you watch the evening news, does it kind of verify that evil seems to be disappearing and people are getting more moral? Yeah.
You said the Bible says, and it does say, a fool says there's no God. Well, to me, a more relevant corollary of that would be a fool says that he can be God. There's always going to be limitations. We're never going to be able to create a sun that will last forever, et cetera, right?
Well,
so it has to be said, you know, I mean, we're never going to be God. You know, there's only one God, and there always will be only one God, right?
Okay, well, that's an interesting approach. Because in looking at the book, there's nothing in the book that talks about... Remember, those of you who are at AMP, you know, Jeff Swearing made the comment, Earth has an expiration date. Mm-hmm. The universe has an expiration date. And so if that's really correct, then these claims have no merit. Mm-hmm. I mean, so what if we achieve, quote, immortality? The Earth has an expiration date. The universe has an expiration
date.
All life has an expiration date. Things are going to get worse no matter what we do with the technology we have. Yeah, Kathy?
Does he address the second law of thermodynamics? Does he address entropy, the law of decay?
The heat death of the universe is ignored.
Okay, so basically that's one thing you can bring to any conversation about the book is that there's this whole part of reality called physics that he's entirely forgetting about. You know, not that, I mean, for us, as this gentleman said, we're immediately aware that we haven't conquered the sin nature. We can't, we won't. Sin is part of humanity. That's not going away. But even for those who don't believe that, we can talk about physics, because physics says things run down. Even those computers, even those other things, the universe is expanding. All that physics tells you that book came from there.
Okay. I think all of us are going to have opportunities to talk to people about this book, just because of all the attention it's getting. What we learned from the conference yesterday, you need to ask questions. Yeah. Always begin by asking questions. Mm-hmm. And you need to find out where it came. Find out what's getting them all excited about the book. That's a good place to start. What is it that you found really fascinating and interesting about the book? Now, if they make the point, what really got my attention, we're conquering evil. Okay, now you can begin a conversation. Is that really the case? I mean, what kind of evil are we conquering? And are we trading evil for evil, where we've got evil going down here, but evil's going up here? Now, let's really look at this. Or they might be going down the path, you know, we're going to develop all this technology, and we're going to be able to live forever here on Earth. Well, is that really the case? What's going to happen to the Earth when we go into the future? So by asking the appropriate questions, what got them really excited about the book? Because there's a lot of pathways you can go. I mean, what I find interesting about the book, it raises almost every issue that the fool can think of to avoid God. And so let's find out what issue they're really fascinated about, and then we can pursue that line of reasoning. Yes?
I just read a book by C.S. Lewis, similar, that refuted this whole thing with the head. I can't remember the name, I have no memory.
Call it a hard drive. We can fix that.
That's evolution. About where they talk, they cut off the head, and they're all the computer.
Huh? Abolition of man.
Abolition of man. Abolition of man. Right.
No, I don't think that's it. No, that's not it.
Is it one of the science fiction novels?
I've read that too.
Hideous Strength.
Yeah, Hideous Strength. Okay. Same thing. Only he deals with the ramifications of it.
Right. So, well, one thing I thought of immediately, even if I had a hard drive where I could put everything in my head, do I really want everything going into that hard drive that's in here? How do I edit that? Yes.
Yeah, well, two things. First, we could really do that. I want your brain. So I'm going to make sure I switch it out.
There are some consequences, though.
But maybe this sounds very simplistic, but one of the things I would ask someone is, well, what do they mean by God? Because if you're Homo Deus, what is their definition of God? I mean, that's pretty...
He does talk about that. Yeah. Where he says, you know, what I mean about us humans becoming God, we become eternal. We're able to take all the evil in the world and make it good. And we're going to solve all of our problems. Disease will be eliminated. We'll be able to bring back all these different life forms that we exterminate. All the damage we human beings have done, we're going to be able to correct all that. That's kind of what he means. Okay? Your question. God has no beginning.
He said, how does?
Oh, how does God have no beginning? Okay, good question. I get that question almost every time I debate an atheist scientist. You know, God has a, you know, the universe has a beginning. Does God have a beginning? And if God created the universe, who created God? And in answering that question, you can make the point the Bible says God's not got no beginning, no ending. He's uncreated. What you also see in the Bible is that God created space and time. And now we've got physics theorems that tell us that indeed space and time have a beginning. They're created, which implies that the creator of the universe is not subject to space and time. And any entity that's constrained to one dimension of time, where time can't be stopped or reversed, that's one thing we notice about time. It goes forward, we can't make it go backward. It can only go forward. We might be able to slow it down or speed it up, but we can't stop it, we can't reverse it. Anything that's on such a line of time must have a beginning on that line of time.
but the one that created time is not subject to that limitation. And a good way to visualize that is to think of this line here as the timeline of the universe. And anything constrained to that timeline must have a start point somewhere along that timeline. But we're talking about the one that created time. He can create any number of timelines as he wants, in any directions he wants, any dimensionality he wants. So, for example, we can think of God operating in a timeline over here that never crosses or touches this timeline here. As such, he has no beginning, no ending. He's uncreated. And the Bible is the only holy book that says of God, no beginning, no ending, not created. Because it's the only holy book that talks about how God does not create within space and time. He creates outside of space and time. If you look at Hinduism and Buddhism, it talks about God creating within space and time that eternally exists. The Bible says space and time do not exist until God creates space and time. And that explains why only the Bible says God has no beginning, no ending. He is uncreated. The Bible also tells us that God can arbitrarily compress time or expand time. Psalm 90, a day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years is like a day. 1,000 years is like 3 hours in the night. So notice that that text is making the point God can compress time as much as he wants or expands it as much as he wants. As a mathematician, that's only possible if God's got access to at least the equivalent of two independent dimensions of time. And so everything in the universe must have a beginning because it's constrained to one dimension of time. But since God is a creator of time, he's not subject to that.
Is time absolutely linear?
Our time is linear. Who knows whether or not God is accessing multiple dimensions of time? He may be able to experience temporality without any time at all. So, we live in a universe with three large space dimensions and only one time dimension. That does not mean that God is limited to three space dimensions and one time dimension. Now, that came up in the Amp conference yesterday, is that one thing that brought me to faith in Christ was recognizing the Bible and only the Bible amongst the world's holy books teaches doctrines that don't fit within length, width, height, and time, which is what persuaded me these other books were inventions of human beings because they show the limitations of human visualization. The Bible, by talking about a trinity and the simultaneity of human free will and divine predestination, its description of heaven and hell, are all things that can't possibly fit into length, width, height, and time. So that was one thing that persuaded me. The Bible comes from a being that's not constrained by the dimensions we human beings are in. And so that's one thing that convinced me. These other books are human inventions. The content of the Bible comes from the one that actually created matter, energy, space, and time. And it looks like I'm being reminded I'm out of space and time.
Well, you're out of time anyway.
So anyway, let me leave you with some assignment for next week. Concerning what we're going to do with the pool. And as I mentioned last week, as you engage these pools and try to bring them to faith in Christ, we need to recognize all of us, to some extent, are pools. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage you to do what Sean McDowell did in the AMP conference yesterday. You want to begin with a testimony of where you were foolish and how God confronted you with your foolishness, and you left your foolishness and began to follow his wise pathways. Rather than simply going to the fool and confronting him and saying, you're a fool, not going to get you very far. But once you can identify with a fool and say, you know what, I'm just like you. I've been foolish. And here's how that got exposed to me. And here's how I was able to respond to that. And so, you know, as I mentioned last week, rather than quoting Psalm 14:1, you might be better off quoting Proverbs 16:25. There is a way which seems right to a man, but the end of that path is a path of death. You know, that's a way to get people to think about these issues. And as I shared with you, that's the first Bible verse I heard in my life, and it got me thinking. So, and I didn't see it as somewhat. In fact, my dad threw that verse out, not directed at me at all. He just kind of threw it out, and but it got me thinking. And when I talked to my dad just months before he gave his life to Christ, I shared that with him. He said, I had no idea that was from the Bible. I just thought it was an interesting statement. So, and he says he didn't even know where he got it from. So, but that's an example of how you can use a less threatening and confrontational biblical truth as a way to get people to think and actually start with a testimony. Here's some of the questions I want to ask. Why does a fool say in his heart there is no God? What are the reasons for that? There's more than one. I want you to think about that. Why does a fool say in his heart there is no God? And keep in mind, sometimes what the fool says, there is a God, but it's a God that really isn't interested in what I'm doing. That's kind of the deistic approach. So a lot of fools are actually deists. In fact, as I mentioned last week, they run into more fools that are deists than those that are atheists. And so I want you to think about that. And how does a fool say in his heart there is no God? How does a 21st century fool say there is no God compared to someone living, say, 200 years ago? And what are the consequences of adopting the philosophical view that there is no God or that there's a deistic God out there? So those are the questions I want us to discuss next week. And now I'm 2 minutes over, so let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for this time we've had today. Lord, it's just a real privilege to be alive in the 21st century, where we see technology advancing at such an incredible pace, and but also, Lord, just how people are thinking that we can somehow become superhuman. And Father, I pray as this book, Homo Deus, is getting more and more publicity, that it would give all of us here in this class opportunities to begin conversations where we can guide people to your truth, your life, and your love. And Father, I pray that it would guide us individually to receive more of your truth, life, and love. May we be transformed by these witnessing and sharing experiences that you'll put before us. In Jesus' name, amen.